At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, I'm Tim Lovejoy, and if you listen to my podcast, The Lovejoy Hour, this week, you'll receive life advice from myself and producer Mark on this month's Midweek Mark, and we discuss the letter L on the A to the Dan of football. Love conversation, love learning, The Lovejoy Hour. Welcome to The Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 Degree Boiling Hot Water, straight from your kitchen tap. Mine does chilled filtered water and chilled filtered sparkling water too. Sparkling water, yes, sparkling water, straight from your kitchen tap. Imagine that. Didn't imagine that years ago, did we? Never thought we'd get sparkling water straight for our kitchen tap, but we do. It's a great invention. I've had some great feedback on the podcast recently. Seems we have a growing community tuning in. Please don't hesitate to suggest a guest for me to have a conversation with. You can email me, lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or tweet me at Tim Lovejoy. Today's hour is 15 questions to music industry boss Alan McGee. As you probably know, Alan founded Creation Records, running it from 83 to 99. He championed acts like Jesus and the Mary Chain, Primal Scream, My Bloody Valentine, and of course, Oasis. His life has been pretty rock and roll. In fact, famously, he said he has no idea how many drugs he was taking in 1993, but that he can't remember anything of the year other than signing Oasis. There's also going to be an Alan McGee biopic starring Ewan Bremner called Creation Stories, which is going to be released in March via Sky Cinema. So we'll talk to him about that too. Let's meet him. Here's Alan McGee. Hello, Alan. How are you?
Good, Tim. How are you, man?
Yeah, been a long time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, since Soccer EM.
Yeah, that's probably the last time I saw you. Yeah, somewhere like that. Either that or XFM. I can never remember. It's all a bit blurry those days now.
And Helen Chamberlain.
That was it. Yeah. Hey, I've just been reading about your new biopic, which is coming out on in March, all about you and Creation Records. That sounds fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's I can live with it, Tim, which is, you know, I think Tony struggled with 24-hour party people. And I know I manage Sean, and Sean can just about live with it. It's I mean, they didn't really like it. Do you know what I mean? Or the factory crowd didn't like, I can live with this. So, do you know what I mean? I think that's actually a result, believe it or not, that I don't hate it.
Have you seen it? Do you know what they're doing in it?
Oh, I've seen it. Yeah, loads. Yeah. I was a consultant. I mean, consultant on the film. How the film came about was I wrote the book, and I'd come down to Wales 12 years ago to bring my daughter up, and eventually I wrote a book and done a deal with it. And I was actually shocked Andy kind of would buy it, but it did pretty well. And Irvin Welsh read it and loved it and went, I want to make a movie with your book. I'll do the screenplay, blah, blah, blah. And it took 5 years to come together. But eventually, Irvin got Ewan Bremner involved. Irvin got Nick Moran involved. Danny Boyle heard about it and jumped on it. And before you know it, the minute you put Danny Boyle's name to anything, Tim, it gets made. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why it really got made. You know what I mean? It isn't any of the other guys. It's Danny Boyle got involved in it, and that's why it got made, because he kind of went, this is worthy of you putting your money. The minute Danny announced he was going to be the executive producer, we got three different offers to fund it. Do you know what I mean? Wow. And it wasn't funded for 4 years. I actually doubted it would ever really get made, but I was kind of thinking, we've got Ewan Bremner and we've got Nick Moran. Pardon me, Nick Moran and Irvin. God, why wouldn't you make that film? But nobody was jumping at it, you know.
Is it weird for you to be as famous as the bands that you were signing?
I don't think calm anymore, mate. But I might be after this bloody film comes out. But I think in the 90s, I kind of was a little bit famous for 5 minutes, really. But now I'm just the guy for the 90s when I meet people, Tim. It's not the same, do you know what I mean? And I don't even want it to be the same, do you know what I mean? I quite like being, you know, the grizzly old man of, like, Indy. You know what I mean? So that, to me, it suits me just to be that, you know what I mean?
All right, let's get through some of these questions then. I've got 15 questions. Let's try and get through as many as we can. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Just don't give in, because if you give in, you've already conceded the result ultimately. Do you know what I mean? If you keep going, half the time it writes itself. You've just got to keep in the game and keep going. So I'd say just don't give in.
What is the role of a record label now? Because obviously years ago it was a very important part of music, especially for the acts.
Yeah.
But now, is it as important? Because they can release themselves, they can promo themselves, they can do a lot of themselves. How different is the role, and how important is it?
I do two things. I mean, I'm the manager for quite a lot of older bands, and then I'm the record label for young bands. And I suppose what I bring to it ultimately is my experience and my branding, ultimately. Do you know what I mean? You know, at this level, I'm just putting records out, little singles out and things like that, I suppose if you're the Clockworks or your Cat SFX, I suppose, you know, being on Creation's a big deal, do you know what I mean, you know? So that's what I bring to it, I suppose. So I suppose I bring branding, but also I kind of know everybody and I can get in most doors and I can elevate people, you know?
But what about the role in those big record labels? Now, obviously, we understand the publishing; they've got to collect the money. But what about the other side of it? Is it important for a band to get a label these days?
I think if you get a really good major label behind you, then it's fantastic. Do you know what I mean? But the big companies now, they don't really snap up bands, but little bands that are unproven. You know, they wait till you're selling out. Well, I mean, we used to do shows, but. They would wait till you're selling out, you know, literally Shepherd's Bush Empire, 2,000 people, and then pile in with their cash. Do you know what I mean? I suppose they're just banks now, big labels, really. Do you know what I mean? Maybe they always were, but I mean, I suppose the way that we used Sony in the 90s was that's the way it worked for us. You know, we signed up to them as distributors, you know, outside the UK. They gave us a lot of cash. We signed a lot of bands. One of them was Oasis, and it worked. Do you know what I mean?
All right. Next question then. What's the best moment of your career?
I don't know, man. I suppose being number one in 32 countries. That was a bit of a moment. Do you know what I mean? When I watched the story Morning Glory out, and I was in this shrinks. It's a true story, Tim. And I'd had to been rehab and I'd had a breakdown, all that nonsense. And I'd got through it. And then I put out What's the Story, Morning Glory. So it was Christmas 95. I was 34 years old. I'd made millions of pounds that year, right? And I was number one in 32 countries. And I was sitting at a shrink with a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, I think it is. And I even tell you their names. It was Dr. Keith Stahl, who's still big, and a guy who's retired, a guy called Dr. Colin Brewer. And I said something like, I never asked for this level of success. It was crying. I'm number one in 32 countries. And they just laughed at me. Like, you just did there. They were laughing because it was obviously ridiculous. And it's obviously utterly wanted it. And I was so fucking stupid and messed up at that point. I never got it.
How you famously said that in 93, you were doing so many drugs and stuff that you can't remember anything apart from signing Oasis. Obviously, it's the end of it is you having a bit of a breakdown and ending up in a psychiatrist's office. But was that a lot of fun? Because I just remember the 90s as just being such a glorious time.
I don't think the crash was any fun at all. But the 7 years leading up to that, what a fucking party.
What was it like when you first saw Oasis? How I know you've answered this a million times, but how soon was it before you went, holy shit, this band, they're the one for me?
Well, I knew they were good, but I didn't know they were superstars when I signed it. I was in Glasgow on a Sunday night, May the 30th, 1993. And a Sunday night, and they were first on by complete fucking fluke. And I showed up anyway to see the other three acts, and didn't know they were going to be on the bill. And I thought they were good. And I thought they were really good, and I'd signed them. But I'd signed loads of really good bands, like Primal Scream, My Bloody Valentine, Teenage Fan Club, and none of them were superstars. So, do you know what I mean? I mean, I just thought they're another one of these good bands that I bump into. Do you know what I mean?
There's a lot in being a band, isn't there? And one of them is, obviously, there's the music, which is important, and there's the fashion, and you've got to buy into something. And I think that's what the Gallaghers bought, is you could buy into it. They were sort of spokesmen for a generation, really, weren't they? I do remember that. I think it was one of the first times I saw them. This is all very, very hazy, because I remember I was on the Big Breakfast at the time, and we were having a good time there too. But I think I saw them on a Gary Crowley show or something. And I remember Liam sort of getting up and going, anyone who wants it can do it. he started doing, they can come and have a go or whatever. And Noel's looking at him, just rolling his eyes. And I just, it's like a comedy act. And I just thought, I love these two. They're great.
Yeah. They're good boys. And I'm still quite in touch with Noel. Quite a lot, actually. Liam, I haven't seen for years. Do you know what I mean? But I'm not in anybody's camp. Everybody thinks I'm in Noel's camp. Well, I think Liam thinks I'm in Noel's camp. I'm not. But I like them both, to be honest. Do you know what I mean?
The other great thing about them was I ended up DJing on XFM. And after a while, there was so many indie bands coming through. I had nothing to say. And I got to the stage where I was like, I can't be asked to interview any more of these bands because I'm not saying anything. And every time Noel Gallagher sat in that chair, you were like, here we go. I've got, bam, an hour's worth of just pure quality sound bites. And it's like, it meant so they could get promo, and they still can get promo, either of them, whenever they want, because everyone knows they're going to talk.
No, very funny people.
Next question. What's the worst moment of your career?
I suppose all the near bankruptcies was pretty bad. Do you know what I mean? But I just didn't give in. Getting back to what we were saying, what advice would you give to people? And I just didn't get them. I mean, we were kind of technically bankrupt for years before Oasis. Oasis saved our fucking ass, man. You know what I mean? Because it was like, we were just about to fucking die, and I'd done the deal with Sony, right? Fuck knows. Really, Tim? Fuck knows why they signed it. Because, yeah, this is 92, before Oasis, right? Because we owed £1 million on the books, 1.2 million. We had Primal Scream at Screamadelica. They fucking signed it, gave me a few million, and paid the debt off. I like carried on. And of course, that for most people would be, right, fuck, we got out of that one. We just continued being mental and like spending as if we were like fucking, you know what I mean, high rollers. And just when we were about to get fucked again, 2 years later, Definitely Maybe came out and sold 7 million. And suddenly everybody went, God, that guy really knows what he's doing. I got away with it, but that's really the truth. Do you know what I mean? I mean, they came in, signed it, and Sony put millions into the company, and I fucking spunked it, as I would. Do you know what I mean? You know, but just at that point, because I was crazy, and then I made the record, Definitely Maybe. Then I went to rehab, and then basically I came out of rehab and it was number one. And then I came back to work in November. I had promoting it everywhere and made What's the Story. And then it was fucking, you know, Sony. I think they would never admit to this, Tim, but they probably put about $500 million on, like $500 million on the share price by having Noel's publishing and having the records. Do you know what I mean?
Wow. We're
a lot of money. That's why whenever I get start really properly talking about Sony, I get fucking bitter, because I know what I got out of it, which is like a slither of that, man. You know what I mean? And I was the one that done it. I was the one that signed the publishing, and was the one that signed the records. So, but it is what it is. It's a record game. Everybody gets fucked.
Well, you know, my next question is an interesting one then, because the next question is, what does success mean to you?
Okay. It's not about money, actually, after I've just had a rant about money. For success, I would say this. I was on something else. Can't remember what I was on the other day, because I've got this film coming out. Success to me is being allowed to do exactly what I want. That's it. Because I don't really make money out of music now. Do you know? I'm not really. Not like what I did then. It was crazy money. I make a little bit of money now, but it's like, so I'm just doing it because I want to do it, Tim. But I'm allowed at this point in my life to do what the fuck I want. So I'd say that's success.
Well, one of my big problems which happened with the music industry, and you can tell me this is bollocks, but in the 90s, it just was so exciting. It was just rock and roll everywhere. The parties were amazing, as you remember, and I remember, and everything was fun. And, you know, there was bands threatening to fight each other and, you know, all that. It was mayhem out there, you know, bands getting off their faces and all that. And then suddenly there was this like real shift. And I remember one of the bands that Soccer M were championing, and I met them a Downing Street thing, actually. Yeah. I'd been invited there, and I'd never been to Downing Street, so I went. And I went up there and I met one of these bands there, and I said, oh, you've got to come back on Soccer M. And they went, oh, we're not in promo. And I went, what? And I'd not even contemplated the idea. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you, because I still make them. I'll tell you off the record. But yeah. I'm like, what? And I was like, Noel Gallagher was on like 2 weeks ago. He hasn't got any music out. He just wanted to talk about City. You know, and it was just that really bizarre thing. And I think there was a real sea change where everyone went, this is about money, not about rock and roll. And it seemed to be a bit more like bands going, how do we write a song? You know, they might as well have written happy birthday songs or, you know, Christmas gigs. You know, it was a bit weird.
I don't think it is actually about money at this point, because I think most of these bands now are, you know, most of these bands at the moment, right here, right now, are fucked at the moment because they can't play. Because, even if you're an old band, like an old 90s band or whatever, right, your Spotify's okay. It ain't maintaining you. And I've got people like Mondays and Cast and all these bands, and usually they can go out and do 30 festivals, Tim, and make X amount of money, a lot of cash, right? But there's nothing happening now. And, you know, I don't think anybody else has got an answer for it. So everybody's like fucking feeling it, you know what I mean?
Mm. Do you know what? It's a weird thing, the music industry, because I was looking at it. Someone, I was reading something somewhere, and someone said the glory days was in the 70s. So that was when the album was invented. And I thought, oh, and you start thinking that obviously the 60s, there was lots of albums, the Beatles and stuff like that. But they're saying the mega album happened in the 70s. And I look back at it, the sort of album started in the mid 60s to late 60s, didn't it? And then. The actual buying of music in that way only lasted until, you know, into the whatever noughties or even before that. And then it kind of died. It's a very short period of time that bands sold music rather than played music for money.
I think the only thing you said wrong there is like you just got the time wrong. The glory time was CDs, because the money that you'd make on CDs, do you know what I mean? We sold 23 million CDs. Creation made about a five on every CD.
Jesus, wow.
A lot of money, man. Do you know what I mean? 23 million Northern Glories out of five. There you go. That's the kind of bread that we were making Sony. That's why when I say the share price jumped. We made them a lot of money, Tim.
Wow. So, yeah, so it's different now, isn't it? I mean, it's all about gigging, and that's yeah. How they make their cash, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, for these older bands, for the younger bands, they're streaming bands, and it's a different concept. You know what I mean? It's just a different thing, and we're in a different world. And I suppose I'm in that world because I'm putting out young bands, but it is a very, very different thing. You know what I mean? People now, so what was that company just got bought, Tim? AWOL got bought for 430 million. And then in one of these music industry websites, I think it was MBW, put up the big selling album. And the second biggest one they've ever had is Jerry Cinnamon. And he sold like 100,000 albums physical. And you're like,
Jesus.
I mean, we were doing like 23 million Oasis albums. Do you know what I mean? On a good day. Do you know what I mean? You know, in context, how these really were the glory days and we all did fucking well out of it. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, it allowed me to, you know, put out my records forevermore with little bands. You know what I mean? And I suppose it allowed everybody else that was involved to be who they wanted to be.
A weird time for music at the moment. I will tack through some of this more these questions, but it's kind of strange because I have Sunday Brunch and we're one of the few shows on TV that puts music on, and there's not a lot of bands come on there, and it's that's not my fault. It's I don't get involved in music booking at all on that show, unlike Soccer AM. But there's not a lot of shows, and then a lot of kids are just like going to their streaming services. It seems that bands have, for this period in time, have been left behind a bit, haven't they?
Yeah, it's a difficult time to be a band. I mean, taking Corona out of the kind of like, you know, out of the, it's crazy time, you know. Yeah, it's just not people. The industry's really safe. Nobody's saying anything. Nobody wants you to say anything, do you know what I mean? And I suppose, hopefully, that's where we pop in, you know, like me and my little band, because they're all opinionated little fuckers, so I've got too many opinions about everything. And maybe eventually that'll happen. Maybe people will go, God, they're actually quite real, that one, you know. And that's kind of what happened in the 80s, you know, when it was just me and Bob and, you know, the Valentines and, you know, fan club. It was just all people that really loved music and all had really strong opinions.
Yeah, do you think off the post-pandemic, or if this pandemic keeps going, it's, you know, I'm just looking at my wall here. I've got a picture of the Specials up, who were my number one band when I was a kid. They had a lot to say for themselves. Horace Painter said recently, which I love, uplifting music with a serious message. And I just love that the way he puts that. But there's a lot to be taught. My kids are at university at the moment. They've got police knocking on their doors every night, asking them if they're with people. It's kind of feels very Eastern European, you know.
Is that for real? Yeah.
Yeah, they're police patrolling in Manchester and in Edinburgh where my kids are. And they're knocking on doors. They're seeing if the kids are. And I'm like, are you accepting that? It's kind of weird to be doing. And I understand why it's happening. But I wonder if the youth are going to start going, hold on a second.
At Manchester Met, and you know, she went on up there to the halls of residence, and she got Corona in the first day or something when she was up. But like, the first week she'd, and I said, and she wouldn't really tell me about it. And then I said, how did you get through it? Were you all right? And she went, oh, we just partied. Everybody had it in the halls, Dad, so we partied through.
They were having Corona parties up there where they were saying, we've all got it or we've had it, come. But if you haven't had it, you know, it was madness going on. But I wonder if that creates a good environment for artists to come along and bands who've got things to say.
You'd have to think so. You'd have to think this is massive, what's just went down. We're in shock from it at the moment. Nobody's really reacting against Corona at all as an artist. I think people are just trying to survive at the moment. You have to think, I sound like a music journalist here, but you have to think something great musically will come out of the angst of this.
Let's hope so. Yeah. Right, next question. What is your outstanding fashion moment? Could be good or bad. You've been in bands too, so you know, what have you had?
I suppose when I was about 16 or 17, wearing makeup, dressing like a buzzcock in Glasgow, with Glasgow hooligans, Neds, that is, right? You know, trying to slash me on buses for, you know, probably thinking I was gay. Do you know what I mean? You know?
Wow. I always say about running when I was a kid getting on a tube into London, which we always did. I come from out near Watford, but we always get the tube in because you wore your fashion, didn't you, in those days? So whatever fashion you're wearing, when you bumped into the other set of lads who were in another set of fashion, it was always so dodgy. You forget that used to happen constantly. Like, what group are you in? Are you, you know, are you a rude boy? You're a casual, are you a mod, a punk, a skinhead? Yeah, it was just
now it's not like that. It's just different. Because it's a bit like that with music now, because you've got Spotify and everybody's got essentially the same set of records to listen to. It's just everybody likes a bit of everything, don't they? Do you know what I mean?
I always say that when I listen to my kids, they'll be listening to the Beatles, followed by the Rolling Stones, followed by Oasis or whatever, then Kate Bush. And you're like, can you imagine being a young band now and having to compete against that lot? I mean, it's insane, the competition.
A lot of the kids are just, it is what it is, isn't it? I mean, you just my son listens to death metal and rap, and my daughter listens to, what does she listen to? Well, she was listening to a lot of Mac DeMarco and Belle Sebastian. Now she's just listening to, is it Alex G? Is that one? Is that some? I mean, I think she listens to whoever that's. It's just different things. Some of it's good, you know what I mean? She's got good taste, man, you know?
Yeah, my kids are all over the place, but every now and then they put some scar and I get really proud. What other jobs did you do, Alan? Did you do anything else apart from work in the music industry?
Oh, of course I did. Yeah. Loads. You know what I mean? I started working when I was 10 or 11. I think it was 10. And I was a paper boy in the South Side News. And that was when I started initially getting into a love of cash, because I went down the first week, I'd heard there was jobs going, because my family were pretty poor and there was no pocket money. So I went down to this Victoria Road in the south side of Glasgow, and I got this job selling the South Side News. And the split, Tim, was 10 pence newspaper. It was like a paper that the adverts paid for it, right? But you could buy it for 10 pence, and I got to keep 6 pence for selling it, but I had to give them 4 pence. So I sold quite a lot. I think I sold about over 100 papers. So that was a good, I think I made about 6 quid. I was at 10 or 11, and back in the 70s, 71, right? That was actually good, right? And then I sort of woke up to it, And I realised that if I went down instead of 6 o'clock in the morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, the guy wasn't there and I could just thieve the papers. So I used to go down and nick 200 papers and keep 100% of the money. And that was the beginning of me. So I'd done that for about 2 or 3 years. And then I got a job in a bakery and I'd kind of almost got thrown out of school. So I had that job. And then my mum and dad, who I never really got on with at all, but they were like, well, no, I got on with my mum, but not my father. And then and my dad got me a job as an apprentice electrician at a Cumbernauld building site, which really just was making people tea and just trying to stay out of trouble, really, to be honest. You know what I mean? Because it was a crazy place. We could riff on that for 20 minutes and make you laugh. Do you know what I mean? Literally. Well, I may as well make you laugh, right? So I was there, and there was such a thing. I mean, all I did was make the tea, right? But what they would do is they would have they have initiation of apprentices.
Yeah.
And they paint your bollocks. Do you know about any of
that? I don't know that, no.
They painted my bollocks, Tim, right? I was only 16, man, right? A little ginger bollocks got painted red, right? So I took it as I would with a smile, right? Okay. But then when they went to do it again the next time, about 2 weeks later, they all got pissed and they thought, let's go and paint his bollocks. I then lost my temper and chased the ringleader around with an iron bar and then made me again. That was my job as then. And then I got a job as on the railways in Glasgow, because it was easy. And then I came to London with Innisfree Primal Scream because we were going to become pop stars. We were now 19. And I was 19, Innes was 17. Brilliant, brilliant musician, right? And me and Andrew came to London. We were homeless. I lived in, well, I lived for 10 days. We were homeless. And I lived in the top of Boots the Chemist in Covent Garden. And then just when we were about to go home, right? This is a bit not giving in, man, right? Just when I was about to. And I, if I had went home, man, this now and everything we've been talking about, none of it would have happened because I'd have had to give in, basically. So anyway, I'm like, why the fuck? We're going to have to go home. And we went to the pub and there was a great-looking girl with pink hair. Punk girl, a wee bit older than me, but great-looking girl. So I went up and, of course, and started chatting her up and was kind of saying, oh, can I come back? I was only 19. I was a chancellor. And she went, well, you can come back to my squat, but not for that, but you can come back and crash because you're a good guy. And stayed there for the next 6 months. And that's how I got my foothold in London. And then from that, when I was in the squat, I started the club, the living room. And then from the living room, I had money to start recording bands. And that's when I met Mary Chain. And that's how I started.
Oh, it's great, isn't it? Like, that sort of story. I suppose it's easier now to do that than ever because you can just record people on.
I think it's hard. I think the only reason I succeeded in coming to London with 5 or 10 quid, whatever it was I had, right, was that I got the squat. And thank God the Silver Tones McGee got in with a great girl who took pity and went, all right, you're a good guy, bit an ugly cunt, but you're a nice guy, come with me. And like, I got in. And then that was the victory moment because I knew, fuck, we're in London, man. We, you know, if we as long as we keep this girl totally cool and sweet, We're away, and we did. When we both cracked it, you know what I mean.
Hi there, this is Majestic from the Same Old Spurs podcast. The very first of our SOS Legends episode is now live and ready to listen to. In episode one, we talked to Tottenham Hotspur and England international Darren Anderton.
Brilliant, obviously, to make your debut against Denmark. Then you move into the summer of 95 when you're subject to a bid from Manchester United. They want to take you and they obviously want to take you away from Spurs.
Yeah.
What was that like to digest? That's a hard decision. Obviously, you're talking about one of the biggest clubs, if not the biggest club in British football.
Yeah, it was definitely a tough one, but the reality was I was so happy. I just had the best season of my career. I was getting better and better. I was arguably one of the first names on the team sheet for England as well.
SOS Legends, episode one with Darren Anderton is out now. Check out Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all the W's.sameoldspurs.com.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a good question for you. What's the key to good relationships? Being a label boss, I mean, that must be pretty tough keeping all those egos going.
That's a good, really good question, actually, to be fair. What is the key to good relationship? There's loads of it, but try and not keep it business, but keep it real as well. Do you know what I mean? You've got to be their friend and their manager. Do you know what I mean? You know what I mean? I'm Sean Ryder's pal, but I'm also his manager. You've just got to be. It's a bit balanced, Tim. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But it's tough, isn't it? Because there's always someone over someone's shoulder saying, you're not getting this, you're not getting that, or, you know, or you could do better here. You could, and you know, you try your hardest and then some arsehole comes in and smells the money. That must happen so often.
Well, I mean, you know, it's just bands. I mean, God knows what we're all going to be like when we get out of the other side with the corona. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there's going to be a few rabid musicians.
Definitely. How hard is it to keep bands together as well?
Yeah, really difficult. really, really difficult. Do you know what I mean? I've always been good at identifying what I need. No, I'll tell you a good story, right? The bands I'm most successful with don't get on. Wow. And I'm just telling you. I'm not saying I want that. That's what happens. If you look back, like Mary Chain, Oasis, Mondays, Scream actually got on all right, actually, to be fair. No, didn't used to, but now you got on all right. But most of the bands that I've had big success with, Libertines, they fucking don't get on. And what I do is I kind of fix it at the time and it becomes successful because you've got all that mad energy. And that's, I don't think I've ever said that publicly. I've said that privately to my pals, go fucking yeah, I'm the king of working with people that hate each other, do you know what I mean? And that's kind of what, well, maybe one of my biggest talents is that, especially the Brothers thing, you know, the Riders, you know, the Reeds, the Gallaghers, you know, the Libertines, it's all the time. And I suppose I make sense of it and make it work.
But I suppose it's that energy that we buy into. I remember going to see the Libertines and I've been in the, you know, knocking around the music industry through Soccer M and XFM and stuff for years. And I'd gone to see the Libertines and I'd done that thing of, you know, I'd heard a bit about them and I thought, you know, we'll go and do that classic music industry thing. We'll have a beer. We'll watch them start, have a beer all the way through and then watch the encore and see what happens. And I remember getting a beer and then the boys came on and I didn't leave my spot with my mouth open going, this is amazing. Their microphone fell on the floor. They went down to the microphone rather than pick it up. And I was like, they're both sharing a microphone on the floor. And I was like, I love this because I haven't seen this stuff for a long time where a band, they just seem so into being in a band. And that's kind of what I bought into. I really liked it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, they were I didn't actually want to manage them, to be honest. I got a kind of, the charm of them, ended up making me manage them. Do you know what I mean? Because how I got involved with them, Tim, was that it was about, their manager at the time came to see me. They put the first album out and it hadn't happened. Rough Trader were a couple of hundred, somebody told me 300 or 400 in, right? £1,000 into their career. And she came to see me and she was worried about them being so fucking crazy, not to get involved or anything. And I was like, oh, gave her some tips and went, oh, for fuck's sake, ho, ho, ho. Right. And just was, like, she was a nice woman. Her name was Bani Pistucci, I think it was, right? She resigned and Rough Trade were freaking out because they couldn't control the band. And then a guy called James Endicott, you must know Endicott.
Yeah, really well, yeah.
So James decided, God knows why, but he decided that I was the one to manage the Libertines, right? So he asked me a few times and I wasn't into it and eventually persuaded me to go down and see Pete Doherty in Catford when he stayed with his sister. Can't remember what her name was, right? So I got a taxi on down and I had a really nice night with Pete Doherty. And eventually towards the end of the night, it was funny, and I'll tell you a story about the jukebox in a minute, right? But anyway, so he was telling me that he's up in pretty a lot of police charges for burglary because he's burgled Carol's flat. And I went, all right, blah, blah, blah. I said, well, what are you saying to the probation officer? Because you wouldn't have to do that before you go to court, right? And everything. I went, oh, how many bothered going? And I know enough about the law that if you don't go and see the probation officer, you're going to prison, right? So I went, you're going to go to prison? No, I won't. Anyway, I didn't think too much more of it. And it went to the pub with him, right? And then we're sitting in the pub, just being sweet with each other, to be honest. And it was an old guy's pub. And at this point, this is just before I stopped drinking, right? So I'm having a few beers with the guy, right? And he goes, I'll go and put some records on in the jukebox. And I went, put your favourite bands, four or five tracks, your favourite band. I went, all right. So I go up and find the Beatles tracks and play Hello, Goodbye and Strawberry Fields, all that stuff that I like, right? Old cunt. And then he went on up and put on five Chaz and Dave tracks, right? And I was just thinking, fucking hell, man, this is the NME's fucking, you know, like Saint and Waiting, right? And he's fucking playing me Chaz and Dave. So then, shook his hand, gave him a hug, and went away. Never thought that I would ever be involved in anything. And then I got a call. I think I was in. I got told he's went down for 3 months or 6 months, whatever it was. Right, didn't think too much more of it. Then went off to America, where I was working with Joaquin Phoenix. Right, so I went off to see Joaquin. I was in New York with Joaquin, and about 6 weeks later, because Joaquin Phoenix writes songs. I don't know. So anyway, so 6 weeks later, I got a phone call, and it's Rough Trade saying, you've got to come back. Like, they're having a leaving party. They're not a leaving party. They're having a party that he's got out of prison. Blah, blah, blah. It was Endicott on to me, and I'm like, I'm not coming back. And like, I'm with Joaquin thinking I'm having a fucking good time. I'm not going for these fucking junkies. No way. And eventually, to get rid of the Libertines, I ended up, came back about 10 days later, I took a meeting in the Landmark Hotel to get rid of them, right? But I'd never really met them. I'd only met Doherty, right? And I end up with Carol and Pete, and they were so fucking charming to him. They persuaded me to manage their band. We left all hugging each other. And, it might have been the champagne, to be honest, right? But anyway, we leave the fucking Landmark, and I'm now managing the Libertines with no plan, right? So I was like, what the fuck do I do? So I thought, because I'm in Wales at the moment, so I've got this big house in Wales. So I thought, and I didn't live there, so I thought, I'll send them to Wales to write the second album, right? So anyway, that Monday or Tuesday, I think it was a Monday, me and little Goatee, this guy that used to work for me, right, take Carol and Pete down to Wales for the week, right? And then we were going to, like, we'll leave the next weekend. That's what we are thinking, right? And Carol and Pete can spend a couple of months writing the album. So that was the plan in my head, right? So the first couple of days, it was kind of a bit gnarly because Pete had been in prison, blamed Carol, blah, blah, blah. And I go to bed on the Wednesday night in this room here, and I'm like going to sleep, right? And they're playing in the background, Don't Look Back in Anger. And I thought that was pretty nice, right? Whatever. And I wake up the next day, go down to the living room, and I'm on the phone, and I hear somebody coming down the stairs. And I look out peripheral vision to my right, and it's a guy that it looks as if there's tomato ketchup being poured over his head, with his eyeball twitching, hanging out on the optical nerve. And I look round, and it's fucking Carol, right? And I'm like, what? And at first I think it's a fucking mask, right? Because I don't know anything about this band. All I know is that the other record company, 300 grand, and I'm supposed to save their career. So I'm around, right? And the eyes out on the optical nerve twitching. So I get one of Charlie, who's my daughter's, baby wipes, and I put it back in the head. And Carol is fucking drunk as a fucking skunk. And I thought, at first I think, oh, it must be Doherty. He must have battered him really properly. I went, who done that to you? And he went, no. Basically, he's a self-harmer. He'd headbutted the fucking sink a couple of times. So I'm thinking, the eye does not look good. So I got the farmer at the bottom of the hill to come up in his truck and take me to Brecon Hospital. And I just, because I didn't know idea how bad it was at this point. And I went in, and they're looking at it going, oh, he's going to lose his eye. You're going to have to go to Hereford Hospital. And that's 30 miles the other way. And they're like, oh, no, So I then go all the way over to Hereford Hospital, and I walk on in, and I'm about 42-year-old, bald, fucking fat manager guy. And Carol's this beautiful, young, 23-year-old pop star. So we walk in, and eventually we get to the... Yeah, we get to see a surgeon. We both walk in, and the surgeon goes, "What have you done to your boyfriend?" Right? And I'm like, "I'm not his boyfriend. I'm his manager." And then Carol, of course, had to eventually go. He thought it was funny, of course, even though he's pissed. But he had to go, "No, he is actually my manager." And Carol had a 6-hour operation, nearly lost his eye. But the NHS, get on this one, right, have sewn it in the wrong way. And then I have to take him back to London and get it re-put back in his head. It cost me $8,000. And that was a week into managing the Libertines, mate.
And it didn't change a lot after that, did it?
Good band, though.
Ah, great band. Yeah, I've watched some great gigs they've done. All right. Next question? How's your mental health now? Are you in good mind these days?
Okay. I mean, I've had moments when I'm managing bands when I've been fucking mad. Do you know what I mean? And not even on drugs. Do you know what I mean? But I'd say it's good. The main thing is, as long as I stay off drinking drugs, I'm always going to be all right, ultimately. Do you know what I mean? I've just got to stay sober. But sometimes the demons get me in other ways. Do you know what I mean? I mean, one of the deep ways the demons got me for a long time was food. And now I've literally lost 40 pounds. I'll put a light on, let you see. But I lost 40 pounds. There you go.
Yeah, you're looking great.
So I've lost a lot of weight, man. So
how are you doing it?
I'm basically, it's mainly keto, it's no carbs, and but I'm walking 15 miles a day, do all my meetings on the phone. Do you know what I mean? I've been watching what I eat, calories, just really, really, I've got that in control. To answer your question, I think I've always been plagued with mental health problems. I'm not trying to make any case for myself at all, but I think I have. Do you know what I mean? But I am on top of it just about. Do you know what I mean? As long as I stay sober, I'm going to be all right. Do you know what I mean?
And the walking thing really helps with your mind, doesn't it? We've talked about that a lot on my podcast, but walking's great.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I know you're going to say you're not, but you are. So this next question, my next question is, what's it like to be famous? And I just want to say before you say you're not famous, because you are, when we booked you for Soccer AM, the buzz in the office was fantastic because you're the man behind a lot of the great stuff that we'd all listen to. And when I said to my producer, who's in his 20s, who works on this, that I'm interviewing you, he said, that's my dream guest, right? So you are famous in reputation and in image.
How would you deal with that is to say I'm not. But I'm not, I accept I probably am a little bit. But my way of dealing with it is just to, see, in my head, I'm a punk rocker for Glasgow, working class, and I'm just that guy, and that's the way I keep saying. Do you know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. But what is it like when you walk in? Because I also saw the celebrities on here, what they think about being famous, and there's very different, differing views. But you walk into a room full of musicians; they all know who you are, don't they? And
yes, they do. Yeah. Compared to what it was like in the 90s, I'm actually not famous now. I'm not really at all. I'm a little bit well known. But in the 90s, it was mad. I bit off more than I could chew, really, to be honest. Because I could have been more low-key about it. But I suppose that was the culture. We were all a bit large. Do you know what I mean?
All right. Next question for you. This is always my favourite question I ask everybody. And I've had some crap answers because most people haven't. But have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
Yes, I have seen a UFO.
Oh, don't tell me you're with Sean Ryder, because I've listened to Sean Ryder.
I was with the Libertines, right? I tell you where I was in America.
Amazing.
I thought you were a dog, you'd read the book. That's why I was going, you must have read my book. No, I get the piss taken out of me about this all the time, but this is what I saw, right?
Right.
I must admit, I was probably a little bit high, so there you go, so God knows, right? But I wasn't as high on dope, substances. But anyway, I was with Gary for the Libertines, and he'd be doing drums. We were in Los Angeles, and it was a producer who's now dead, who I can't actually back my foot. What was his name? Nick Leman. Me, Nick Leman, and Gary for the Libs. And we're walking out, and as we're walking, going about 8 o'clock at night, dusk, right? It's in Santa Monica, right? And we're walking, and the above, you know how the overhead lines, Tim, they're not like that. They're like that. They're thick, right?
Big lines, yeah.
Right. Not skinny. They're fucking fat, right? So anyway, we look up, and the overhead line wire above our head is feeding back. And we're like, is it going to come down? That's what we were thinking. And while we were looking up, something comes on the way up, and like, I think out the fucking sea, but from sea level up, the fastest thing I've ever seen. And it literally went pink. I'm spoiling my credibility with you now telling you this, but it goes blue, red, blah, blah, blah. And in and out, the fastest thing I've ever seen, like a rocket, in and out of sight. We probably saw it for about 6 seconds. It was mad, right? And I told people, I told Joaquin Phoenix, I was hanging out with Joaquin the whole time at that point, and they all just thought I was fucking nuts. Do you know what I mean? And Gary, if you ask Gary, Gary's taking the piss out of me today on Instagram, going, when I'm crowd, I put a picture up in the snow going taxi, and he's going, oh, you looking for a UFO again, McGee? he was there and he didn't see it. I saw it, Nick Leman saw it. But Nick's dead, so it's just me versus Gary. And he didn't see it. Do you know what I mean?
Have you talked to Sean Ryder about it? Because he was on Joe Wood podcast talking about he's big into it, isn't he?
Oh yeah. Yeah, no. He did his show about it, and yeah. I mean Sean utterly believes he sees them. Do you know what I mean? He doesn't, it's not because he says he sees them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, I've got it. He believes he sees it. So I've got to think he maybe in his head he's seeing it. I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm cynical about fucking UFOs, but I did see something that I can't explain. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I love all that stuff. That's why I asked the question. I've never seen anything, but I love it. And I believe anyone who has. Can I ask you a question, which is a really hard question to answer, but just to see if you've got one. Is there your favourite gig you've ever watched? Is there one where you thought, it doesn't get better than this?
Yeah, Complete Control Tour Clash, 77, 78. And the Clash, there's footage around on YouTube. In Glasgow Apollo, 78, Complete Control had just come out, that tour. And that's just unbelievable. And they were like, every one of them was a front man. Just the greatest looking rock and roll band in the world ever. Yeah,
I've been watching lots of music documentaries recently, and I watched one on the Clash and the troubles between Strummer and Mick Jones, and it's such a shame. But you know, they had all that tension. That's probably what made them great.
I mean, I managed Mick for about 5 minutes at one point, and I was mates with Joe. You know, I mean, I went down to see him a few times in Somerset, and he came to my birthday party, my 40th birthday party, just before he died, actually, about 2 years before he died. Came to my birthday and all that. So I knew them all. Simon and I've known forever, since the 90s. Just good people, good guys.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, what a band. I watched I watched the Bee Gees documentary as well. Oh my God, that band's just was amazing, wasn't it? How many different ways it changed.
I mean, Bee Gees were great before they went disco. And then when they went disco, they were fucking better. Do you know what I mean?
Well, all right. What's the happiest you've ever felt in your life?
I could say something stupid and go, like the very first E I ever took, which is the truth. It was fucking amazing. Getting together with my missus way back in when I met her. Do you know what I mean? And I'd fancied her for 4 or 5 years. She was in this band, Fraser Chorus. And then I was just this wee indie kind of spunker. And then I became like a big indie spunker, and then I managed to pull her. So it was pretty good.
All right. But before I ask you the last question we're going to do, what are you up to at the moment? What do you spend your day doing? I mean, you've got your record label now. Are you full on with that, or are you, you know, what, how are you juggling your time these days?
I talk to Sean every day. I've got the Mondays, I've got Black Grape, I've got Cast, I've got Las Vegas, I've got The View, I've got a Kyle Falter album coming. Brilliant record. Literally, Tim, if I get it on the radio, it'll be a number one record. And then I've got the label. And then I've got the film coming. And then there's a documentary coming. And then I'm losing weight. I'm pretty busy. I'm okay at the moment. I'm good. I mean, I'm actually, if I keep myself focused, I'm good. You know what I mean? It's when I don't focus on shit, I become fucking ill. You know what I mean?
Yeah. How are the View? I haven't seen them for a while. No, it's top blokes.
Yeah, good guys. I mean, they're going to come back and let the pandemic pass. But Kyle is brilliant. I mean, how they got me? I've always been working with them 6 months. They sent me an email out the blue going, McGee, it's time. And I was like, you know what? You're so cheeky. I'm going to go up and have a meeting with you. And I went on up in the middle of a pandemic, sneaked up. And 6 months ago, and met them. And they're really young. They're only 33, 34. And they still look good because they got signed when they were 16. So they look good. And then Kyle being Kyle because he's fucking mad. Do you know Kyle?
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something in a minute. Yeah, go on.
Kyle goes, oh, I've got this solo album I'm about to go and make. And he went and made it in the Libertine studio, but it had a big American pop producer. He used his bounce back to record with this guy, Frankie Siragusa, big American pop producer. And it's got about 5 hits on it. If I get it on the radio, Jeff Smith fucking does his a solo down my way. Do you know what I mean?
I did an interview when I did an internet thing years ago. I was doing internet content called Channel B. I don't know if you remember. It was very, very short-lived, but it was just, we were a bit too early, but a lot of the boys from Soccer M were on it, and we loved the View, and we got Carl to come down. Carl turned up, though, and he got to London early or got to wherever early, and he'd got bored. So he went and just got absolutely hammered, bought himself a full Adidas tracksuit, and he bought some piano gloves, some gloves where, you know, as you move the things around, it plays piano. He then turned up and did the interview with me, and it's like legendary in circles, because you can see it on the internet if you just put Tim Lovejoy and Carl from the View in, and he's so drunk, and I don't know what to do apart from I'm really enjoying it, and people love it because it's like a proper old school rock and roll interview where he's making no sense at all, and it's fantastic. And I that's what I want my rock and roll guys to do, you know, turn up every now and then for an interview and get drunk.
He's got it in abeyance at the moment. It's like, you know, I just said to him at the beginning, I said, we're in a different world now, mate. You're going to just have to fucking, whatever you do in Dundee, you can do. Don't let it hit the papers, but do what you're going to do. But when you're in business with me, you're going to have to be totally together, because we're going to get slaughtered. Me managing you and us both being Jakey's. So he's been cool. Kyle's good.
Great band. Final question, Alan. Thank you so much for your time today. But final question is, what is the meaning of life?
Your kids.
Okay.
You know what I mean? At the end of the day, my son, troubled kid, prison, addiction, you know, abandonment issues because the mother wouldn't let me see the kid for 16 years, come through it. And I'm supporting him through lockdown. And, you know, I've been supporting him for his whole life, to be honest. But it's like supporting him through lockdown, get him through it. And my daughter, little snowflake, indie fan, but amazing. Great, and both amazing kids. And it's like, ultimately, as long as my kids are all right, it's probably okay.
Mate, love talking to you. Really enjoyed this conversation. And hopefully it won't be so long next time.
Yeah, all right. You know, send me the link and I'll put it up, all right?
All right, cheers.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.